Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, we're going to talk about vanilla with you for a bit here. The scent of vanilla is a treat for your nose, and the plant it comes from is a treat for your eyes. And we're going to talk with the world's leading expert on vanilla orchids, Kenneth Cameron. Ken's a professor in the Department of Botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He directs the conservation biology major at UW, and he's also the director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. So lots we can talk about with him, but we're certainly going to zero in on vanilla with him and on that plant. And I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about the vanilla orchid? Are you familiar with the State Herbarium? Join in the conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or go ahead and send us an email. The email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Ken Cameron, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Are you ready to take a trip to the tropics and talk about orchids?
Oh, yeah. You know, I spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad and Tobago, and so orchids were everywhere there, and I love to see them. And, you know, and vanilla, of course I love vanilla. You know, it's used in practically anything you can imagine. I like vanilla ice cream. Now, a lot of people say, you only like vanilla ice cream? Well, I love vanilla ice cream, most of it anyway. But
I tell a story of I moved here from New York. I was at the New York Botanical Garden for 10 years, and I was out with a donor who described a story where he was at a fine restaurant in New York City, and they came around, and he said, well, you know, what do you have for dessert? I said, well, we only have ice creams. You know, we don't really do dessert here. And he said, well, what flavors do you have? Well, we don't really have any flavor. All we have is vanilla.
And you wonder what, you know, you get, there's this saying, oh, it's kind of a vanilla, you know,
yeah,
this and that, but dang it, vanilla.
Oh, it gets my blood pressure up. There's nothing further from the truth. When we use that word as an adjective to describe something boring or plain or conventional. Vanilla is truly a remarkable orchid. It's far and away, it produces the world's most popular flavor and fragrance. And as you said, almost any product you can think of probably has vanilla mixed into it. I ask my students to think about what they did from the minute they woke up until they go to bed. And you think, well, I brushed my teeth, I used mouthwash, I washed my hair, I put some conditioner in, I took some pills that were coated with a nice flavor and so forth and so on. Almost all of those have vanilla as a flavor or fragrance.
Is that amazing?
And vanilla ice cream still outsells all other flavors combined. You know, forget about Baskin-Robbins 52 flavors. It's all about vanilla.
Well, and you've come to the right place here, because here at the University of Wisconsin, we make some pretty darn good ice cream, and there's a there's a pretty darn good vanilla.
It's the best.
it really is. Oh man, Ken Cameron, our guest today, professor in the Department of Botany at UW-Madison, talking with him about the vanilla orchid and vanilla itself. Tell us about this plant we get vanilla from.
Yeah, so most people are surprised to learn that vanilla comes from an orchid. We often refer to the fruit as vanilla beans. They're not beans, of course. They're not in the legume family. They are technically berries. They're fleshy fruits with many seeds inside. But, you know, sometimes people might call them pods. So this is one of the few orchid species out of a family of 25,000 wild species. You know, the orchids are the largest family of plants on Earth, and yet we've only domesticated one out of all those 25,000, and that's the species Vanilla planifolia. which is native to Central America. We believe that it was domesticated, you know, thousands of years ago, long before Europeans ever came to the New World, probably by the Totonac people in the area today we would recognize as the state of Veracruz in Mexico.
Yeah.
And they continue to cultivate vanilla in the traditional way. But after Europeans discovered this plant for themselves, they took it back to the old world. The Spanish probably took it first, but sort of lost interest in it or just never developed an interest in using vanilla in Spanish cuisine, whereas the French became absolutely enamored, infatuated with it. And being a tropical plant, the French took it to their tropical territories, places like French Polynesia, Tahiti, places like the island of Réunion or the Seychelles or Madagascar, all of which were under French control. And today, in fact, that part of the world, those islands of the Indian Ocean, especially Madagascar, are the center of vanilla production. However, since the plant is native to Mexico, the natural insect pollinator that's needed to produce vanilla fruit is absent in Madagascar and in those other places that I mentioned. And so vanilla flowers must be hand pollinated. There's a very narrow window of opportunity each morning when workers go out into the plantations and hand pollinate each individual flower. And then it's a very long and laborious process of waiting for the fruits to mature, harvesting them, curing them, fermenting them, drying them, grading them. And so it's no surprise that vanilla ranks as one of the world's most expensive natural commodities. The only spice that fetches a higher price, your listeners may know, is saffron.
Yes.
but vanilla is so popular. And its popularity really is growing as new markets emerge. I go to China almost every year as part of my research on projects other than vanilla. And I remember the first time I went there, none of my colleagues had ever heard of vanilla in China. But today you can walk the streets of Shanghai and Beijing and you can buy ice cream. There's Haagen-Dazs stores. And so now there's a new market emerging in parts of Asia for natural vanilla. And that leads to some of the problems that you alluded to in your introduction. You know, it's so popular, demand is growing, but coupled with climate change and some pathogens and some other factors really have people concerned about this.
You know, Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, I think has a question. Probably you may have partially answered it, at least partially, but let's go there. Pat, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I did call about the pollination process, and I was thinking, I remembered it was a fly who pollinated the plant, but I don't know which country or anything, and I wondered how that fly is doing and if you could talk more about that.
Sure.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I'd love to elaborate a little bit more on that. It's not a fly, it's a bee. And more specifically, in the neotropics, so parts of Central and South America, there are specific bees that we call orchid bees. In fact, they're euglossine is the technical name for those bees. And they have a very curious life history where the males go around the tropical forest collecting fragrances. They collect these from flowers, from the resin of trees, from decaying wood or fungi, and they collect fragrance. They store it in little pouches in their legs, and then it's really strange. All the males gather together in one place in the forest, and they do sort of a courtship ritual to attract females. And the male who has the nicest perfume tends to mate with more females. So those are only found in the New World, that type of bee. And for a long time, we didn't actually know what the pollinator of vanilla was. But now it's been recorded on cameras that a certain type of these orchid bees, these euglossine bees, visit the flowers. Now, I do have to step back for a minute, and since I was mentioning fragrance, the flowers of vanilla themselves actually do not contain much of a fragrance. The bees are tricked. They're lured into the flower thinking that there might be a reward or nectar or fragrance, but they don't find anything. And that's a common strategy that's used by the orchid family. We call it deceptive pollination. The flowers trick the insects into visiting them, oftentimes into mating with them. They mimic female species, females of the species, and help the plant to reproduce. The second part of your question was, how is that insect doing? So unfortunately, not very well. Even in Mexico, where these plants are originally native, so much of the landscape has been altered. This area that I described in Veracruz is mostly now converted from cloud forest, beautiful, pristine, virgin cloud forest, into agriculture and mostly cattle and citrus, a lot of orange trees in that area. And the local people say the climate has been altered. It's just too dry now, and we rarely see those bees, and we have to grow the vanillas under shade cloth and so forth. So, there's a lot of concern about that. I will mention one more thing about pollination biology, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I mentioned that we have to hand pollinate the flowers. The humans have to do that. And for decades, maybe even a century, nobody quite figured out how to do that. They were growing vanilla vines around the world, and they just weren't making fruit. A young slave boy by the name of Albius, Edmund Albius, who was a slave on the island of Reunion, actually figured out how to do this. And went to his master and explained, I think I figured out how we can make the vanilla fruit. He completely revolutionized the industry that we take advantage of today. A lot of people have been celebrating his achievements last month during Black History Month. And he was granted his freedom as a result of that discovery. But he died a pauper. He never saw any benefit financially from that invention. Fortunately, the people of Reunion do recognize that, and there's a nice statue of Edmund Albius on the island of Reunion.
Oh, what a story. And we have some more stories for you as well, as that when it comes to talking about vanilla the vanilla orchids with our guest today, Kenneth Cameron, Kenneth Professor in the Department of Botany at the UW-Madison, director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium as well. So we can talk about the herbarium a bit as well with him. And you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Ken Cameron. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the vanilla orchid on the show today with our guest, Ken Cameron. Ken is a professor in the Department of Botany at the UW-Madison, director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. He's also the world's leading expert on the vanilla orchid. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about vanilla? Have you ever visited the State Herbarium? You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. Ken, how the heck did you get interested in vanilla and the vanilla orchid?
Oh, you know, science is such a strange process. You start out researching one thing, and then you discover something unexpected, and it takes you down a different path. I have been interested in orchids ever since I was a kid. I grew up in Michigan, and my family, like a lot of Wisconsin families, would go up north every spring to pick morel mushrooms on our property at our hunting cabin up north. And, you know, sometimes you spend many hours not finding any mushrooms.
Yes.
When you're a kid, that's kind of boring. So I started paying attention to the wildflowers that were in bloom at the same time. And the pink lady slippers flower around that time in May. And I became absolutely enthralled by our native orchid. Fast forward like 20 years, and I'm a college student, and I still liked orchids as a hobby, but I never imagined you could make a career out of that. And fortunately, I had a really good mentor, a professor at my college, who said, you know, you love orchids so much, why don't you go to graduate school and earn a PhD studying orchid biology? And I said, you know, you can do that? And he was like, yeah. So it just happened to be that this was in the 1990s, when we were just starting to have the technology to sequence DNA. And so my PhD ended up being the first study to sequence DNA across the entire orchid family to understand their evolutionary relationships so that we could devise a better classification system for the most diverse family of plants on Earth. So that's pretty ambitious. The results were, you know, the first results I'll never forget this day. I started analyzing the data, and I'm like, vanilla is really weird. What is going on here? This is not the result I expected. It turns out that vanilla and its close relatives form their own unique subfamily within the orchids, and they're very primitive. We've subsequently been able to use those genetic tests in combination with some fossil evidence and some computer modeling to date the age of the orchid family and vanillas, and it's a very old family. We estimate that orchids were on Earth during the time of dinosaurs over 100 million years ago.
Wow.
And vanilla is one of these kind of relict genera of plants that is found on multiple continents. They were probably connected as Gondwana land at that time, and they're still with us on Earth today. So just a remarkable plant. And the deeper I started diving into vanilla and the biology, the more I realized that despite the fact this is the most popular, you know, agricultural orchid on Earth and a multi-billion dollar industry, we just didn't know, still don't know very much at all about its fundamental biology. And so that's where my research has been over the last 40 years or so.
Mm. Laurel, in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling, Laurel.
Hi. I just have to share a couple comments. Number one, I read a wonderful book that was called Hooked, and that particular book shared that there's a substitute for vanilla right now that they chemically created that's called vanillin, and that's put in a lot of products, and they kind of promote it as being real vanilla, but it's basically a chemical composition that has the same odor, same smell, but it's not vanilla. The thing that I'd like to share is that I had a chance to go to Hawaii a few years ago and visited the vanilla farm and learned that you can make your own vanilla by taking 3 vanilla beans that you can buy at your local co-op or wherever, and you put it in a very tight fitting jar or bottle, and then add pure alcohol, whether it's gin or vodka, and let it
or brandy.
Or brandy, in the dark for 6 months and shake it every day, and you will have the best vanilla you could ever make. Now, in
Absolutely.
Mexico, I just had a chance to get back to from Mexico a couple weeks ago and bought vanilla down there because they always claim that the Mexican vanilla is the best. However, most of it that the tourists are buying because they think they're buying great vanilla is with a lot of water added to it. And you really have to be careful and watch if it has aqua in the label of ingredients because they take you for big money for stuff that's watered down.
Yep. You bring up some really good points there. Gosh, I could talk an hour about each of those elements that you just mentioned. You are absolutely right. Synthetic vanilla has been around for a long time. And it's really quite easy to manufacture in an industry. Traditionally, artificial vanilla is a byproduct of the wood pulp industry. So paper making companies and other big companies that work with wood pulp are also oftentimes involved in making these synthetic vanillas. It's also easy to manufacture as a petroleum byproduct. And nowadays, we have genetically engineered bacteria that in the laboratory and cultures can make that molecule that you mentioned, vanillin. So the tricky part to this relates to labeling. So everything I just mentioned, wood pulp, oil, bacteria, those are all natural parts of nature, right? I mean, trees are natural.
Yeah.
And so sometimes the label will say natural vanilla flavor. But that doesn't mean that it came from the orchid. The best advice I give people is, just like you said, it should be an alcohol-based product. In fact, the USDA or the Food and Drug Administration has guidelines about that. I think it has to be at least 35% alcohol. And really, the buyer should just beware. You get what you pay for. So if the price seems too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah.
And especially as you're coming out of Mexico and going through the duty-free shop, you know, they sell big gallon jugs of vanilla extract. A lot of that has not only been diluted with water, but it's been cut with Coumadin, which is a blood thinner and a carcinogen. So I would tell people not to buy that. I like your advice. Go to Penzi's Spices, buy some natural vanilla beans, chop them up, put them in your favorite booze in a glass bottle, and you'll really enjoy it. The last tip I'll give, since your previous guests were talking about food and cooking and so forth, you know, we tend to think of vanilla recipes of like desserts and frostings and cupcakes and things like that. But add a little bit of vanilla extract to your gravy the next time you make a pork roast. Think about a seafood dish, a creamy base, you know, scallops or shrimp. Put a little vanilla in that. You will be amazed how a little bit of vanilla can really enhance not only sweet but also savory dishes.
Mmm. Oh, you're making me hungry.
Laurel. I know. I haven't had lunch yet.
Oh, man. Laurel, thanks a lot for calling. I really appreciate it. Maddie in De Pere, we'll go to you next. Hi, Maddie.
Hello. I didn't hear at the beginning of the show, so maybe you already answered this question. Did the Aztec or Mayan Indians have something to do with the development of the technology of producing the vanilla?
I talked a little bit about that, but I can elaborate a bit more. So the people who live in the what we today recognize as the state of Veracruz on the eastern shore of Mexico are the people we believe first domesticated vanilla. So I'm not sure they're actually Mayan or Aztec, but they are indigenous, an indigenous group. However, the connection to the Aztec is fascinating. You may remember from world history class or something that the Aztec king or emperor Montezuma was famous for consuming great quantities of chocolate. So chocolate is native to that part of the world. And supposedly he was drinking chocolate as a beverage. But keep in mind that there was very little sweetening agent. You know, we didn't have sugar cane in the New World. Honeybees were never, you know, here originally. And if you eat bitter, if you eat raw chocolate, it's bitter. It's horrible. And so it's said that the Aztecs would flavor the chocolate chocolatl beverage with cornmeal and some chili peppers and other spices. But the main thing that made it palatable was vanilla. So we know that, that the Aztecs traded with the Totonac people and almost treated vanilla beans as a form of currency in exchange. If you go to Mexico City, incidentally, in the Zocalo, the main downtown region where the cathedral is, in the old palace building, the Mexican artist Diego Rivera, the husband of Frida Kahlo, painted huge murals depicting the great civilizations of Mexico, pre-Columbian Mexico. And he has a wonderful mural of the Aztec and the Totonac people standing in front of a great pyramid. And right between those two great civilizations is a vanilla vine. It's a wonderful story, and it tells such a it goes back to why we cherish this plant so much.
Oh, what a great story. Maddie, thank you so much. Appreciate it. You could join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, mailman Jerry in Linden Station emailed to say he's wondering what effect vanilla has on wildlife such as deer. There are some cover scents made that smell like vanilla and claim to jam a deer's sense of smell to aid in covering up the human scent. And he's wondering if there's any information on whether vanilla has the ability to do that.
You know, I have never heard that. So I'm really intrigued. Thank you for enlightening me. I'm going to look that up. What I find so interesting, though, about that is that the main molecule within natural vanilla is called vanillin, as I mentioned. And the human nose can detect that molecule in incredibly small quantities. Furthermore, it's a molecule that lingers. It lasts for a very long time. That's why almost every perfume or cologne recipe, even the the proprietary secret ones of Chanel No. 5 or something, they all have vanilla in them as a base note element because it persists from morning all the way through to the end of the night. It's a really, really important molecule. So deer being mammals, I assume they might also have the ability to pick up on that molecule the same way that we do. So it almost sounds counterintuitive that you would use it as a cover-up because you might be luring the deer in with it. So maybe that's your goal. So, you know, cover up your scent and lure the deer into your blind. I don't know. I'm going to have to look that up. But thanks for bringing it to my attention.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look at some of those deer scents and see just on the back and see what they've got or how they're marketing it. It's pretty cool. So someone wondered, is it possible to grow the plant at home?
Oh, I was hoping someone would ask that. Well, obviously, we're in Wisconsin, which isn't quite the right habitat for growing tropical vanilla. But it can be grown indoors. I grow orchids under LED lights in my basement. And I have a big, giant vanilla vine that's thriving down there. A lot of people, you know, if you have a greenhouse, of course, it's no trouble at all. If you do want to try growing vanilla, a couple things to consider. First of all, it's a vine. It's one of the only climbing orchids. And so if you're going to grow it in a pot, you need something for it to climb onto, a support structure of some sort of trellis, let's say. The other thing is that everything you've ever learned about growing orchids, they don't grow in soil. They grow only in bark. They like to dry out between waterings. They want to stay cool and humid, all of that, full sun. Forget about it. Because vanilla breaks all the rules. It does want to grow in soil. It's a terrestrial orchid. It likes rich compost. It grows in the shade on the in the understory of rainforest, so not in full sun. It likes very warm temperatures, and it likes to be wet. It likes to stay fairly damp. I'm not going to say, like, not waterlogged, but don't let it dry out between waterings. That sounds a lot like many houseplants, right?
Yeah. So,
you know, if you have the right little spot in a sun porch or, you know, in front of a window that has filtered light, give a vanilla vine a try. Almost certainly it won't flower. They need to get really large, be really happy and healthy in order to flower, and they only bloom once a year anyway. But the foliage is really quite lovely. It's a glistening emerald green. It's a nice, and it's a conversation piece, you know, when the neighbors come over.
Yeah, that's, it sounds great. Mary from New London has a question for you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask more specifically about the herbarium and how you store plants. When I was in college in the early 80s putting together my plant collection for biology class, there was a very specific routine and how to mount them on the right kind of paper and how to store them. And the herbarium, the small herbarium case at my former employer just got cleaned out and tossed because the plants are 45 years old and they've fallen, kind of turned into dust. And so I'm wondering if there's a new technology for collecting plants and storing them and still many years later being given the opportunity to learn from them.
To be honest, we use the same methods that Linnaeus was using back in the 1700s and earlier. I'm disappointed to hear that those collections were damaged and thrown out, because we probably could have salvaged them. It's not a sophisticated process. Basically, I guess I should step back for a minute and explain to the listeners that a herbarium has nothing to do with herbs. It's not, you know, rosemary and thyme. It's a scientific collection of pressed and dried plant and fungal specimens. And the Wisconsin State Herbarium here at UW-Madison is one of the largest in the world. We have approximately 1.3 million specimens, which puts us in the top 10 in the entire Western Hemisphere and the fourth largest university herbarium in the Americas. So we've been doing this for at least since Wisconsin was a state in 1848, but we've also adopted, we've brought in collections that have been abandoned or orphaned. So the technology is pretty simple. My colleagues and I go out every year. We choose specific places around Wisconsin or other countries with a plant press. We collect with legal permits, of course, and dry those in a press. And then we usually take advantage of some great undergraduate students and some even better volunteers who come in use Elmer's glue to place the specimens on acid-free cardstock with a label and all the appropriate information. So that's pretty much the same way I suspect that you did it when you were a student. The one difference is that now we are in the digital age. And so before we file those specimens into the collection, we take a digital image of the entire specimen, we database it, and we calculate the latitude and longitude coordinates. And we make all of that data available on our public databases so that we can share the information worldwide. And that's that. The URL for that is herbarium.wisc.edu. And we work with a consortium of other herbaria around the state to document the flora of Wisconsin. There's a lot of information there for you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you, Mary, for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Linda emailed, and she says that she's made bottles of vanilla for Christmas gifts for quite a long time. And if you want to start if you want to do that yourself and give those as gifts, you ought to be starting right about now.
Good point. Yeah, my basement is full of empty bottles. Every time I see an attractive bottle, I hold on to it thinking, you know, this will make a great Christmas gift. Either vanilla extract or Kahlua, which is a coffee vanilla product, make nice Christmas gifts.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I tell you what, Ken, this has been so much fun. I'd like to have you back sometime and talk about more about orchids in general and what's going on at the herbarium. I think not everybody knows how many orchids we have here in the state, and I think it'd be a lot of fun to do that.
Yeah,
so tell me you'd be willing to come back.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Ken, thanks. Kenneth Cameron is a professor in the Department of Botany at UW-Madison, director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium, and he's got a lot of enthusiasm for a lot of things, but certainly for vanilla and vanilla orchids. Great to have him with us, and thanks for the great calls, too. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the new Wisconsin Dreamers Center, set up to help individuals in Wisconsin who qualify for DACA programs. And then at 11:45, we'll talk with American poet and essayist Rita Dove. Really looking forward to this. We'll talk about her latest collection of poems. That's tomorrow at 11, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. But hey, stay with us. Lots in store right through the afternoon on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.